Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Szczepańczyk. On today's show, we'll feature a truth track, an audio documentary which hopes to rock hard as it seeks to inform, educate, and inspire. This week's truth track is entitled, Love Me, I'm a Neoliberal. We'll also include a summary of news about media and democracy entitled Media Minutes. But first, let's hear these news briefs courtesy of The New Standard. A Muslim woman sues Goodwill for alleged workplace discrimination. A Boeing executive is caught bribing an Air Force official, but the contract may stand. Activists hold hearings on voting rights in Ohio. A scarcely debated anti-choice clause is passed by Congress. And more than 1,000 Floridians are still homeless after a hurricane. A Virginia woman has filed racial discrimination charges against Goodwill Industries after her former boss allegedly refused to allow her to wear a religious headscarf at work and then fired her. In her court filing, as reported by the Roanoke Times, Jennifer Abdelwahed, a convert to Islam, said that her boss told her she could not wear a hijab at work because she had not been wearing one when she was hired. On a separate occasion, according to the filing, Abdelwahed asked why her co-worker was allowed to wear a bandana on his head, but she could not wear a headscarf herself. Abdelwahed alleges that her boss told her it was because we are not at war with him. Goodwill's stated purpose is to serve people with workplace disadvantages and disabilities by providing job training and employment services, as well as job placement opportunities and post-employment support, according to the organization's website. Abdelwahed worked at a store which generates revenue used for that mission. But the organization denies that discrimination was involved in Abdelwahed's subsequent firing, which the company says was for being late to work. Abdelwahed is suing to get her job back, lost pay, compensation for suffering, and attorney's fees. A top Boeing executive admitted in court on November 15th that while his company was working out a contract with the Department of Defense, he offered a job to the person representing the Air Force at the negotiation table. The guilty plea by Boeing's former chief financial officer, Michael Sears, came after Darlene Druyun, the Air Force official with whom Boeing was negotiating, admitted that she had allowed the company to charge taxpayers excessively for refueling tankers. Druyun had then left the Air Force to take a preferred position at Boeing. In spite of the scandal, the contract at the center of the controversy has not been voided. Its status is in question, but Boeing is hoping it will still win congressional approval. Both Sears and Druyun have agreed to cooperate with the ongoing investigation into Boeing's contracts. Druyun is currently serving a 9-month sentence for violating federal conflict of interest regulations. It is unclear how much jail time, if any, Sears will receive. Meanwhile, the government is continuing its investigation into the contract negotiations in order to find out if other Boeing officials were involved in criminal conduct. According to the Chicago Tribune, an internal email, discovered by an internal Boeing investigation, shows that Sears told three other top Boeing officers about a meeting in which he offered Druyun a $250,000 a year job. Boeing has not released the exact contents of that email, reports the Tribune. In addition to helping Boeing on its refueling tanker contract, Druyun admitted to doing favors for Boeing on other contracts while the company gave jobs to her daughter and future son-in-law. The General Accountability Office has been asked to look into Druyun's contract negotiations. Public hearings in Ohio, initiated by a coalition of voter advocacy groups, concluded on November 16th with the promise of lawsuits over voter disenfranchisement and a recount to be filed in Ohio. Nearly 200 people gave sworn testimony during the 2-day hearings, held at the New Faith Baptist Church in East Columbus and at the Columbus Courthouse. Among the complaints listed by people who voted or tried to vote were snaking election day lines and widespread confusion over new precinct borders. Groups like People for the American Way, Common Cause Ohio, Citizens Alliance for a Fair Election, and the League of Pissed Off Voters, all co-organizers of the event, contend that state election practices systematically suppressed voters in lower-income precincts and violated constitutional laws guaranteeing all U.S. citizens equal right to vote. While voter advocacy organizations involved in the hearings plan to pursue separate lawsuits, a shared interest in a reformation of the electoral process that goes beyond the 2004 election unites them. While they concede that lawsuits will most likely not overturn the most recent election results, they want to make sure that every voter is heard at the polls next time. In a move that one pro-choice activist called our worst nightmare, Congress approved legislation allowing health care providers to refuse to provide or pay for abortion services and referrals. The Federal Refusal Clause, as it is known, passed as an amendment to a massive appropriations bill on the weekend of November 17th. It prohibits states and local governments from filing lawsuits against doctors, HMO, other health care providers, and insurance agencies for not providing women access to abortions if those governments receive federal funds of any kind. Pro-choice organizations slammed lawmakers for allowing the legislation through after the House attached the amendment to its version of the bill, and the Senate allowed its inclusion in the final bill without debate on the floor. While anti-choice groups hailed the measure, saying it will prevent the government from forcing health care providers to participate in the, quote, killing of unborn children, unquote, women's rights groups declared the bill's passage a blow to women's health care. In a press statement, the National Organization for Women accused Republican congressional leaders of rewarding their right-wing base with a, quote, backdoor maneuver of the worst kind, unquote, and, quote, attempting to destroy a woman's legal right to receive reproductive health care services, unquote. A spokesperson for the Federal Emergency Management Agency says that hundreds of people who lost their homes in Hurricane Charley still lack temporary housing. Many are staying with friends or family, renting apartments, or living in hotel rooms. According to FEMA's Dennis Kizia, over 1,000 requests for emergency housing have not been met in Florida's DeSoto, Charlotte, and Hardee counties. Kizia, who spoke to the Associated Press, said that the agency has managed to provide almost 1,150 people with temporary housing in the form of travel trailers in those hard-hit areas. Democratic Florida Senator Bill Nelson called the delay unacceptable, reports to the Associated Press, quote, "The question that has to be asked 90 days after the hurricane is why are we only able to supply travel trailers and mobile homes to half the people who need them?" The cause of the housing shortage was, in part, chalked up to permitting problems. These brief reports come to us courtesy of The New Standard. We encourage you to support independent, nonprofit, anti-commercial news sources like The New Standard on the web at newstandardnews.net. You're listening to the Ministry of Truth.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Major changes to U.S. copyright law that would have criminalized activities like file sharing and fast-forwarding through commercials in a taped television program have died in Congress, for now. One bill would have called for 3-year jail terms for anyone caught sharing copyrighted material on a peer-to-peer network. Another would have essentially rented the Department of Justice out to music and movie companies to do their copyright enforcement work for them. A significantly watered-down version of the legislation drops those controversial provisions, but still proposes more funding for the DOJ to carry out investigations into copyright infringing activities. Stanford University law professor Lawrence Lessig says regulation in this field has been all but captured by media conglomerates and their trade associations to the detriment of the public interest.
The political system has driven us down the wrong path because we don't have a good way to get politicians to listen to the other side. They don't even understand there's another side to this debate.
The watered-down list of copyright tightening rules cleared the Senate just before Congress broke for Thanksgiving. There will be one more shot left to get the bill off of Capitol Hill in December if Congress returns to work on some other unfinished business before year's end.
Cable and phone giants Comcast and SBC waged a bitter battle during the November election to stop three Chicago suburbs from creating their own municipal fiber optic information utility. An advisory referendum on ballots in Batavia, Geneva, and St. Charles from the citizen advocacy group Fiber for Our Future would have provided high-capacity voice, video, and data services over a publicly owned fiber network. Fiber for Our Future Chairman Annie Collins said they lost by a scant 700 votes, but only after SBC and Comcast spent tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars lobbying against the plan.
Full-page ads, commercial time, 30-second commercial spots on TLC and Discovery, the yard signs, and purchase call center hours for push pulls, bringing in van loads of people from Chicago from SBC and having them walk the neighborhoods on the weekends.
What resulted was a massive disinformation campaign against municipal fiber service. It claimed, among other things, that the project would result in higher taxes and fewer telecom-related jobs in the three communities, when in fact, the very opposite was true. Collins believes a municipal fiber network would have provided residents with more bandwidth for less money. Municipal fiber would have also made money for the cities in the long run, once subscription revenues recoup the cost of network installation. More importantly, those fees would funnel back into the community instead of to some corporate headquarters in Texas or Pennsylvania.
I'm a housewife, okay, from Batavia, Illinois, and I was facing the president of SBC Illinois. You know, with all due respect to her, why were those big guns here?
Comcast and SBC recognizes the threat municipal fiber poses to its own bandwidth businesses. But the dream isn't dead yet. A printing snafu placed the referendum on ballots in precincts not affected by the proposal, meaning hundreds of people voted on it who shouldn't have. Collins says this means the question could return next March, marking the third time in 2 years. But unless citizens can find a way to counter the deep pockets of the Comcast-SBC lobbying juggernaut, she's not hopeful.
I guess it's plain to see right now that people are satisfied around here with average. People are satisfied to pay high prices for subpar services. People are okay to have their telecommunications destiny spoon-fed to them.
To learn more about the struggle to bring a public fiber network to the suburbs of Chicago, visit tricitybroadband.com. Again, that's tricitybroadband.com.
And now here's a Media Minutes Fast Fact. Have you ever heard of the Telecommunications Development Fund? It's a program that was created by Congress in 1996 to help fund small communications firms and spur competition and innovation in new technologies. From 1998 to 2001, more than 40% of the fund's money, that's $7.25 million, went to cover salaries and administrative costs, while only $9.4 million was actually invested in just seven companies. FCC Chairman Michael Powell appoints the five-member board of the Telecommunications Development Fund, which notably includes himself. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
This is the sound of hundreds of factories in the United States. In the last 4 years, millions of Americans have lost their jobs, and U.S. companies get billions in tax breaks for outsourcing jobs to poorer countries where exploited workers make pennies on the dollar. George W. Bush will be inaugurated in Washington, D.C. on January 20th. Send him and his congressional supporters a message: we don't support your economic policies. Rally in Chicago on January 15th, and get on the bus to protest in Washington on January 20th. For more information, call 773-209-1187. That's 773-209-1187. Presented by the Chicago Counter-Inaugural Organizing Coalition. This is the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stjepanchik. On today's show, we'll feature a truth track, an audio documentary which hopes to rock hard as it seeks to inform, educate, and inspire. This week's truth track is titled, Love Me, I'm a Neoliberal. Freedom is a goal we all want. It's more than just for show. Democracy is worth fighting for as a tool for those from below. But saving the planet breaks trade rules, so we'll see you at the WTO. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a neoliberal. With apologies to Phil Ochs, we're not talking about liberalism, but about neoliberalism. The term neoliberal was effectively coined in Chicago with the 1962 publication of the book Capitalism and Freedom by Milton Friedman. In the book, Friedman describes himself as a liberal, invoking a spirit of freedom. After all, the Latin root liber, from which the root liberal derives, means free. But the freedom here is not the kind of political freedom to pursue enlightened thought. It's the presumed economic freedom, that I'm free to make as much money as I possibly can, and that anything that gets in the way of my right to make money, like your taxes, is wrong and should be removed. Neoliberalism presumes that markets are the best way to handle economic matters, that whoever has the most money wins, that anything which can't be placed into market relations, like public resources or social safety nets, should be abolished. But much like the Holy Roman Empire, which was neither holy, nor Roman, nor an empire, neoliberalism is neither new nor in keeping with the traditions of Enlightenment liberalism. In fact, neoliberalism is anything but enlightened. Neoliberalism is not new, since calls for a resurrection of the kind of Dickensian market seen in 18th century Britain at the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, where, and quoting from economist Robert Solow, infants become deformed as they toiled their way to an early death in the pits and mills, unquote. And neoliberalism isn't at all keeping with liberalism, since in a context of such cruelty and suffering, it's hard to be able to pursue anything resembling enlightenment. The Great Depression brought into question the notion of unfettered markets, which helped to lead to the New Deal and improvements in the labor rights movement. But lowered profit rates, coupled by the development of 20th century social movements like the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, and the environmental movement, forced profit mongers to attack these social advancements, to broaden the scope of markets, and strengthen the enforcement mechanisms for keeping within markets. That's the point of what's called the entourage of the transnational corporation, embodied by three organizations: the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the World Trade Organization. The IMF and World Bank both engage in predatory loaning practices to indebted third world nations, offering them loans if nations destroy their own social safety nets and natural resources to provide cheap resources or pools of cheap labor. It's described euphemistically as structural adjustment. The WTO is even worse, as it forces countries to override its own rules in favor of environmental protection or workers' rights. Otherwise, the WTO enacts huge sanctions against violating countries. But neoliberalism has faced a backlash. In the past 5 years, the IMF, World Bank, and WTO have faced growing criticism and worldwide protest. The ministerials of the WTO have collapsed twice in the past 5 years, and narrowly avoided a third collapse. If the criticisms and protests continue and widen, as signs are showing that they are, then the entire neoliberal enterprise could be thrown into disarray. Even more importantly, new economic models which transcend this market and state dynamic are being articulated, and even in some places, implemented. The most developed and most powerful model is that of participatory economics, which, according to a citation from Italy's Pio Manzu Institution, constitutes the most powerful and fully articulated challenge to the current models of socioeconomic thought. The stark assertion of Margaret Thatcher, that there is no alternative, is making way to the World Social Forum's credo, another world is possible. To learn more about neoliberalism, check out the websites for Global Exchange at www.globalexchange.org and CorpWatch, Watching Corporations, at www.corpwatch.org, CORPWATCH. To learn more about participatory economics, visit www.parecon.org, PARECON. We'll be discussing more about participatory economics in a future Truth Track. For now, this concludes this Truth Track. And you're listening to the Ministry of Truth.